Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, we're looking ahead to Charlotte's next 20 years. But first, let's take a ride in the Wayback Machine to a time we call the 60s.
Is Charlotte's downtown on the road to growth, prosperity, success? Or is it teetering on the edge of another road, a road to decay and decline? In the midst of big city glitter, some observers note signs of tarnish. In the midst of economic boom, small signals of future danger. They say Center City has problems that must be solved and solved now before the clock runs out.
Time is running out. Congested streets, inadequate parking, retail vacancies. We can't wait any longer to solve these problems. It's do or die for downtown Charlotte right now.
Those final comments, the ones warning of do-or-die circumstances here in Charlotte, come from local architect A.G. Odell. He and his firm started what has become a 50-year legacy of planning for future development. And now it's time to do it all over again. This month, Charlotte Center City Partners hosted hundreds of residents and civic leaders at Camp North End, where they started a conversation about what needs to happen next in and around Uptown. It's part of an 18-month, $600,000 study expected to be finished late next year. And that report, the 2040 Vision Plan, is coming together at the same time several more studies for future growth are taking shape. Joining me today, I have four experts well-versed in what former President George H.W. Bush used to call the vision thing. And they are Michael Smith, who is the CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners. Good morning.
Morning.
Also here is Lorna Allen. She is senior urban designer with the City of Charlotte's Planning, Design, and Development Department. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Eric.
And here from UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute is Eli Portillo, who is assistant director of outreach and strategic partnerships.
Morning.
Good morning. And last but not least, and bearing the shortest job title, is City Councilman Larkin Eggleston.
Hello, sir.
Hello. I should mention that Larkin Eggleston's district includes portions of Uptown, so his constituents are directly affected by the 2040 plan in particular. So we have a lot going on, as I mentioned, at one time. So I want to start with we have the 2040 Vision Plan, which, Michael, is your baby in a lot of ways. But we also have several others underway or just finished. And, Eli, you recently wrote about the 2040 Vision Plan, the 2040 Comprehensive City Plan, the North Tryon Vision Plan, and others. So could you start us out by explaining some of the differences and nuances among these various plans?
Sure. There are a lot of plans either underway, recently completed, or soon to kick off. That includes plans from non-governmental groups like the Center City Plan, which will set a vision for the next 20 years. That includes the Charlotte Unified Development Ordinance and Charlotte Comprehensive Plan that the Planning Department is working on and has been for a while. That is expected to be approved sometime in early 2021. There is CATS detailed planning for their 2030 transit plan. There is the Mecklenburg County Park and Recreation Master Planning effort. And there are several smaller planning efforts and various visions underway now. So there's a lot going on, and they have different levels of rules attached to them. Some are vision plans that might set the tone or set aspirations, and some, like the Unified Development Ordinance rewrite, will come with real hard rules and regulations attached to them. So there's a lot of nuance in this vision game.
And so for listeners, every time we say the words vision or plan, you have to take a sip of your favorite beverage. Michael, as I mentioned, you had the Camp North End plan, Camp North End event to kick off the 2040 plan. What is this process going to look like, and how is it similar or different to what you did for the last one, which I think was in 2011 that one was approved?
It was begun in 2009 and adopted in 2011. And we're fortunate. We've got this legacy of planning that, as you shared from the great Giulio Odell, do or die time.
Do or die.
that we've been doing this for 50 years. And what's amazing about this community is that these plans are not owned just by government. They are owned by NGOs, nonprofits, and by our corporations. And that's how we've had the success we've had, is we have common inspiration that's vetted through professionals, and then it becomes adopted as policy and then acted upon. And we're beginning now an 18-month planning process. The Center City Vision Plan, the 2040 Center City Vision Plan, is it's not Center City Partners Plan. We are part of a partnership with the city and the county. It's the three of us working together on it.
Equally funded, by the way, by those three entities.
Equally funded and operated. And, you know, we end up doing a lot of the staffing of it, because when we own it, we hope to be instigators to continue to keep it front of mind on policymakers, so that everybody participates and we end up with a plan that we can act upon. But the hope is that we are able to ask our community, what are your hopes and dreams and inspirations for your center city? And that is a countywide and even region-wide ask.
Before we go much farther, staying with you for a moment, Michael, in terms of what these plans have done in the past, could you give our listeners maybe some examples of ideas that turned into reality from these past plans?
It's pretty amazing some of the stuff that's gone on. If you reach way back, you can look at things like the pedestrian plaza at Trade and Tryon. That was an idea from the O'Dell plan in 66. Identifying where Bank of America Stadium is today was identified roughly in that plan. The location of the view as a 50-story high-rise, you know, it didn't say 50 stories then, but high-rise residential, that was 66 O'Dell as well. Some of the high-rise office was 71. The specific siting of the NFL stadium was again in 1990, the creation of the government center, clustering around Little Sugar Creek. Those are all older plans. But you know, when you look back just to the 2020 plan, there were things like the creation of a ballpark neighborhood, you know, anchored by BB&T Ballpark and Ramir Bearden Park, which has now triggered over $1 billion of new investment. The development of the city-owned parcels along Stonewall, really creating a new place for our community that now is on track for $2.5 billion of development. And that's property that wasn't on the tax rolls or is now being upcycled. The creation of a new South End Vision Plan, a North Tryon Vision Plan, the creation of the last plan called for Charlotte becoming a city of bikes. And now that's hard to reflect on, but in 2009, you would see people on messenger bikes, and that was about it.
Yeah, that's true.
And the density has improved, and part of it was, you know, the creation of Charlotte B-Cycle, and then some competitors coming to town, and just being more friendly with infrastructure. So that's just a quick sample.
Lorna Allen, so you're obviously in the city planning department. For you and your colleagues, you're not only helping pay for that 2040 vision plan, you're helping with obviously some of the process, but you also have, as Eli mentioned, you have the Unified Development Ordinance going on, and you have this comprehensive city plan, which will be the first one, I think, since 1975. One of the big challenges for you, though, is to make sure that you're not duplicating, but that you are collaborating and cooperating. So what are you doing to juggle all of those things?
So we have a lot going on, as you mentioned.
You might need to leave right now and go, yeah.
Yeah, I think I have something on my calendar. No, we do have a lot going on, but, you know, I think the spirit of the way we have been planning in Charlotte over the past 50 years has been very collaborative. And the fact that for the 2040 up to our Center City Vision Plan, it's truly a collaborative effort. We are partnering to do that project management. And I don't know if Michael or anyone has mentioned it yet, but the theme of our plan is All In 2040. So we really have taken that to heart. We are rolling up our sleeves, shoulder to shoulder, getting this work done. But at the same time, being very cognizant of not overlapping or not missing gaps. So the same with our comprehensive plan, which is a citywide view of how we're going to grow over the next 20 years. Center City Partners is at the table for that. We're working with our partners across the region, University City Partners, to make sure that we are all working together to create this vision for our community for the next 20 years.
So the comprehensive plan, I don't think people are as familiar with that one, obviously, because it hasn't been done in so long. So is it a combination of transportation, transit, neighborhoods, those kinds of things?
Absolutely. It's not only land use policy, but it's overlapping all of the systems that make our community function and make it a place to live, work, and play. So we're looking at our community across the board, and we're trying to understand and decide as a whole, as a community, how we're going to grow over the next 20 years. And that will encompass how we get around using transit, how we grow in certain areas and preserve in others. So that's a big part of what we're talking about right now as we're developing the place types. We're in the second phase of the plan, and we're developing and deciding how we're going to term different parts of our community. What do those look like? What do they feel like? What's that character?
So, Larkin Eggleston, for you and your council colleagues, obviously you make the decisions on whether to spend money on some of these things. Most of these studies are hundreds of thousands of dollars. How do you, I guess, in the first place, tell your constituents that this is money well spent, but then secondly, make sure that they make use of this in terms of paying attention and understanding why this is important?
I mean, I think it's important because if we're making policy decisions every time on a one-off basis, I think we're not going to get the same level of results as if we have a plan and then we're working the plan. I think it's also important that we're at the table and we've got the right people at all of the tables for all of the plans that are being done. Them being done simultaneously is helpful because we can make sure that they align with each other and they speak to each other. Historically, we've had plans that maybe were done in silos that then as you come to us as the policymakers, and we want to make sure that something meets one plan, then it inherently doesn't meet another. And so we've had these plans that weren't in alignment with each other. They weren't in alignment with the reality of things like the zoning on certain parts of town. And so then people have these plans that they've invested a lot of time, money, and effort into, and we can't actually make sure that they come to fruition. And that frustrates people. They go, well, why did we make this plan if that's not what it's going to end up being? And so I think by having all these working at the same time, we can make sure that they're not in conflict with each other, that we're getting everybody's input at the same time. Michael was talking about the people who have ownership of these plans. What we really want is for the community to have ownership of these plans. We want them to be invested in the outcome of the plan itself, but then in the outcome of what that yields in terms of how we build our city.
So going back to the 2040 vision plan, which is the one that looks at Uptown and some nearby neighborhoods, Michael, one of the things that you said to me at the event a couple weeks ago was that not only do you want to have a lot of these focus groups and public events, but that you also want to go to people who may not be able to come to you. I guess two things on that. Is that a new protocol? And then secondly, how much of that have you mapped out at this point?
Well, it's always been the aspiration. So for the 2020 plan, we did focus groups where we were able to catch youth using the transit center. So that was one of the clevernesses that we were able to bring new voices to the table. But we'll use focus groups, and we will try to be there's new technology today, so there are new ways to capture the voices of more of our citizens, and we're going to bring a lot of that to the table. It is not 100% mapped out for the next 18 months, because part of what we'll do is, as we move along and we learn what's working and what's not, we'll adapt. One point that I wanted to make on how one of the ways we're trying to coordinate the comprehensive plan and the Center City Vision Plan is we've hired the same consulting team. It's a great firm called MIG. They're out of Berkeley, California. They know our community. They were our consultants for the 2020 plan, for the North Tryon plan, and now working with both of us, it allows us another level of coordination among those plans.
I want to pick up on that point when we come back. We're going to take a break, but we have, of course, big plans of our own for the rest of the hour. Stay with us. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are discussing a wide range of vision plans today. With me on the panel, we have Michael Smith from Charlotte Center City Partners, Lorna Allen from the City of Charlotte's Planning Department, City Councilman Larkin Eggleston, and Eli Portillo from the Urban Institute at UNC Charlotte. And Michael, when we were going to the break, you mentioned the California firm MIG. They are working on the 2040 vision plan. They're working on the city comprehensive plan. I believe they did the North Vision, North Tryon vision plan.
They did.
And they did the previous vision plan for you, correct?
They did the.
I think I just said vision 13 times. Go ahead.
You
I'm
did.
Sorry. Yeah.
And for the drinking game, that's very hard for your listeners.
Yes.
So those that are still with
that's
us.
That's right. It's only orange juice. Go ahead.
2020 vision plan they also worked on, and that was a wonderful plan for us. And what was interesting about this journey to where we are beginning our 2040 vision process was, you know, we began with the question of, boy, that was a solid plan. Should we think about an edit instead of a fresh beginning? And then you start to reflect on the last 10 years of our community and everything that's changed, the things that the way we've become a more premier place, the way we've grown, and then some insights we've had into how we can do things better.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask Eli, I was reading some of the things you had written recently at the Urban Institute, and you were going through some of the numbers. For example, the population of Uptown, which includes South End, I think the way you define it, has doubled in the past decade. And then you look at some of the development just all around us. There are cranes. So how much has it changed from your perspective in the past decade?
Well, the past decade defines the time I've lived in Charlotte. So when I moved here, you know, there was one brewery. The light rail was brand new and didn't go to UNC Charlotte. There was nothing on the south side of Stonewall Street at all. I mean, the changes, I feel like I'm becoming an older Charlottean because I keep saying, well, when I moved here, maybe that's just part of the natural progression of things. But I think it's particularly interesting to look back at these older plans and see how, in some ways, they kind of encode the sensibilities of the time, almost, you know, like the proverbial fly in amber. Mm-hmm. If you look at the 1966 Odell plan, there's a lot of, you know, stuff in it, good stuff that came true. There's also a lot of stuff in it that now in urban planning we kind of, you know, look at and say, whoa, we don't want to do that. The plan's very auto-centric. There's a lot of stuff in there about bringing in bigger highways to downtown and bringing in more parking garages, getting more cars there. And, you know, the Brooklyn neighborhood at the time, an African-American neighborhood, was in the process of being removed through urban renewal, as it was called. And the Odell plan is very enthusiastic, as most of the plans were in that day, about removing what they called blight and replacing it with the government center. Well, fast forward all these years, and we're trying to undo a lot of that now. We're trying to bring back some residential into what's now being redeveloped as Brooklyn Village, trying to get away from big auto parking garages. There's talk of capping the 277 loop on the south side. So a lot of these plans reflect what's going on in the culture at the time, and a lot of times you look back on them, you're like, wow, that is kind of dated now. So it's going to be very interesting to see in 2040 or 2060 what we look back on now and say, huh, maybe we should have done that differently.
That's Eli Portillo from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Larkin, I was going to ask you, Eli just made a good point about the Brooklyn neighborhood, for example, and the county has the agreement with a private developer that was reached 3 years ago, and we've this summer heard about some requests or some calls for reparations in terms of what happened to the families who lived in Brooklyn. How do you untangle? I know that's not directly your decision, but you're in the public sector. How do you think a situation like that can be untangled?
Yeah, I mean, it's a contract the county entered into, so city council won't be able to weigh in on that in terms of a vote. I do think that one of the biggest stains on the history of this community is what Eli just talked about, which is the quote-unquote urban renewal that eliminated a thriving black community in this city. And so I hope that as we continue to develop the city, continue to develop that part of the city, I know that the county's thinking about it. I know that the city's thinking about it. We need to make sure that we are trying to make amends for the wrongs of the past. I mean, we know better now, so we need to do better now. And I hope that that we will make sure that there is an appropriate amount of affordable and mixed income housing incorporated into that development, as we need to be making sure that it is in all our developments. So nothing about that plan was perfect, obviously. In fact, some of it was quite shameful. I hope that the plans that we're making now are more inclusive and are more thoughtful about the impacts that they'll have, both good and bad.
Michael, I want to ask you for, and this is a very straightforward question, but for people who don't follow this closely, how do you define Center City Charlotte for the purposes of this study?
The way that we define it is it's kind of a chalked line. It's Uptown, South End, and the adjacent neighborhoods. So it is the urban center of our community, which is constantly changing. So therefore, it's a little bit more of a chalked line. So you'll see a lot of the recommendations are very specific inside of South End, Uptown, Midtown, but probably become more suggestive, but have a lot of the voice of those neighborhoods trying to inform some of the ideas and policies and recommendations of the plan.
I mean, for example, you have a large steering committee. I think it's 30, 32 people.
Yes.
And one of your co-chairs is Clay Armbrister. He's the president of Johnson C. Smith University. And that university is obviously the anchor for the historic West End, which has become a bigger and bigger part of what you do. If you could just go into a little bit of how that came about and why that part of the city has become more important to Uptown Charlotte.
Well, there is a lot of change going on in the West End. And we have to make sure we're intentional about it because it's proximity. The fact that it is now going to be on the Gold Line, the streetcar line, which will open in 21, there is a lot of development interest. And it is a neighborhood with incredible history, African-American history for our community. And it's a community that has suffered from disinvestment. So you want to balance new investment and new services, but in a way that doesn't displace the families and the individuals that want to be there. But we're proud to be working with the university, and that's part of the area of this plan, this study.
I just want to say, Eric, on the topic of Johnson C. Smith, President Armbrister is a great guy. I'm really glad he's involved in this. And I think that my hope is that in the same way that the Blue Line extension really made people feel more connected to UNC Charlotte, I think when I moved here 15 years ago, people didn't really have residents didn't have much of an ownership of UNC Charlotte if they didn't have a personal connection to it. I think people feel more like they do now. I hope that in the phase two of the Gold Line opening, people will feel more of a connection to Johnson C. Smith because it really is just out the front doorstep of Uptown Charlotte. And I think that it's a huge asset to this community. And I hope that people start to take more personal pride in it, even if they don't have a educational connection to it, but just see it as one of Charlotte's institutions.
Lorna, I'm curious from your standpoint, obviously city government, state government, there are always plans and guidelines being assembled or being adjusted. But when you go through these types of processes and it's also your job to make this reality, to enforce it, how much do you have to say to people, oh, slow down here. We have to have, you know, some standards here. This has to be workable. And in the case of Uptown, you know, this has to fit into the broader context of the city.
No, that's a good question. I will say Michael brought up a good word that we've been throwing around a lot through this process, and that's intentional. And I think that's definitely following on the heels of the comprehensive plan. Before we even started the plan, we set on a big engagement process with our community and made sure we were sharing and educating our community on how we've been planning over the decades. It wasn't always inclusive. It wasn't always intentional. And we made some missteps. So this time around, we're really trying to make sure that and ask the question, who's not at the table? And by doing that, we're bringing everyone along. We're making decisions together. We're educating together. And the ideas that are coming out of coming from the community are coming from a place of understanding where we've been and where we want to go. So we're getting some really great ideas, some of them not always the most realistic. But, you know, I think we've been getting some really good ideas now that people understand how Charlotte has grown over the years and how planning has affected that growth.
And I think you bring up a good point, Eric, that a lot of times, you know, what you have on the page in a plan needs to be reflected in, you know, regulations and hard rules to become reality. I was reading the 2010 Center City plan recently, and there's
you do have fun at home, don't you?
Yes, yeah. I love printing and reading these old plans. And there's a note in there specifically about large parking garages in downtown and how that's a suburban development pattern that they would like to get away from, to have either buried parking or less parking and more reliance on transit. You know, that plan was approved in 1999, I believe. Fast forward 20 years, and we still have very large parking garages going up next to most of our urban buildings, not buried and not reliant on transit. So without, you know, hard rules changes to make the development patterns reflect what's needed in these plans, they don't always come to pass. So that's where, you know, the rubber really meets the road and you move from the realm of the theoretical to reality. And I think that's going to be something important to keep track of moving forward.
Larkin?
On the topic of parking, I think it's also amazing the number of surface parking lots we still have inside of 277. So my thing that I'll say I hope we see in this plan is I think by 2030 there shouldn't be a surface parking lot inside Uptown Charlotte, inside 277. It's an absolute miss in terms of tax revenue that we could be getting off of whatever else would be there. But also we've got to make sure that this plan, more so than any of the past plans, and to Eli's point, we've been saying this for a while, but only really starting to do it recently, has got to be less car-centric.
Councilman endorses mass tow truck operation.
Right? Did I get that right? Definitely not what I said.
Just kidding. I just want to make sure you're listening. To remind everybody, our panel is Michael Smith from Charlotte Center City Partners, Lorna Allen from the City of Charlotte's Planning Department, Eli Portillo from the Urban Institute, and City Councilman Larkin Eggleston. Let's dig in a little bit in what's going on uptown because there is so much. Michael, last week your group announced a $1 million donation from U.S. Bank to build a long-desired pedestrian bridge connecting the South End neighborhood with Center City, and you were talking a lot about how this could be a signature-type project. And when you go through these planning exercises, you also often are looking at signature projects. So give us a little context on that pedestrian bridge and how that may fit into some of what you're looking at in the future.
We are so excited to have that project moving forward. It began with great leadership from City Council making the investment in that, being followed by County Commission and joined by the state so that we could go out and secure private donations.
It's about $11 million project, I should
say,
right?
$11.5 million. And it interrupted one of our most vibrant centers, which is that rail trail in South End. And to any listeners who have not been there, get out and explore. It is our High Line, our Beltway from Atlanta. It is so many of those developments have developed both to the road and now also to the rail trail.
And the rail trail is about 3.5 miles of paths that go along South End, but then you would have to find a new route to get across 277, right?
Yeah, so people would come up.
Well, you still do. I'm saying it like the bridge was built last week. It was not.
You know, as this bridge is built, then part of the plan for the redevelopment of the convention center is to also add a pedestrian bridge that will cross from that light rail station to the convention center and eventually through it and carrying it all the way up to the north. And those are big moves. I mean, connectivity for ped and bike are so 21st century. It is tomorrow's talent wants those walkable, bikeable, transit-oriented cities. And we're in a war for talent, and right now we are winning it. So we need to make sure that this plan understands how we're winning, why we're winning, and what tomorrow's talent and workforce is going to want.
And it's interesting, South End, for example, and Eli, I think you wrote about this, about how it was envisioned and in many ways was a design district, and now all of a sudden in recent years, actually recent months, it's turning into a major office center. You have Lowe's is going to occupy basically what, a 23-story tower. You have LendingTree is going to take up the majority of an 11-story tower. You have the Dimensional Fund Advisors, which was sort of the pioneer for office.
Allstate.
So all these things are happening. So how is that shifting what you do? I mean, for example, South End, the streets obviously are not that big. And even though you have light rail, how do you move people through there as you get more density?
Well, I think that's a really good example of how the market can change, and you know, what's reflected in a plan is not necessarily what gets built, because the market is generally in our system more powerful than a planning document. So if you look back at previous plans, there's a lot about making South End a design district, lowering a arts and design school, really making that the focus. Now South End is really emerging as a huge Class A office market, as you said, and that brings new challenges, you know, the need for more roads, the need for more ways to get around, and shifting technology also plays a role in here. When the 2020 plan was approved, it's interesting to look back on it because there's not any mention of ride-sharing services like Lyft and Uber. There's no scooters.
You didn't see the scooters coming, Michael?
you know, Uber had just been founded in 2009 at that point. Lyft was still 3 years away. E-scooters were almost a decade away. So markets and changing technology are really tough to anticipate when you look forward decades. And, you know, now these planners are going to have to consider things like autonomous vehicles. What are those going to do for transportation? What are, you know, the next generation of e-scooters going to look like? And what is the technology we can't even imagine that's going to change how things are built? So it's a tough game to look ahead decades.
Roads like Camden Road are never going to not be congested again. So I think things like light rail and rail trail give people options if they don't want to be in their car and they don't want to be stuck on Camden Road. A lot of those roads we're not going to be able to widen, nor should we necessarily want to. I think we've got to just give people options to get out of their car. If they want to live in South End, they want to work in South End, they need to have choices.
Lorna, I'm curious, again, for you, these things all happen out in the world, then you have to put them into some kind of order, right? So when South End explodes in a different direction, how is that affecting what you're doing at the city?
It's a constant challenge to stay ahead or keep up with it. I'll be very frank about that. I mean, I've had a front row seat in South End. Our Charlotte Powerhouse studio is, our urban design center is right there on Camden, right across the street from DFA. And over the course of a month, we saw that part of South End transition from a neighborhood where people went to work and then came home. It was a bedroom community, and it's turned into a full-service neighborhood, like, almost overnight. So that was very exciting. But at the same time, thinking about how that impact is going to disperse across the city in our urban neighborhoods, where are we going to see more development and more offices and more full-service neighborhoods happening? So with the comprehensive plan, we will be looking at those place types, those characteristics that make a neighborhood and community function more fully.
That is Lorna Allen from the City Planning Department. We'll have more on the various vision plans going on in Charlotte. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are talking about various vision plans for Uptown Charlotte and the broader city. With me today is Michael Smith from Charlotte Center City Partners, Lorna Allen from the Planning Department at the City of Charlotte, City Councilman Larkin Eggleston, and Eli Portillo from the Urban Institute at UNC Charlotte. And during the break, Michael, we were talking a little bit about population growth. And Charlotte was the fifth fastest growing major city between 2017 and 2018 and has been among the fastest growing areas for decades. So put that into context for us, how that ties into the vision plans.
Again, when we were thinking about how important it was to rethink our values and aspirations in this plan, when you think about how our city has changed just in who's here, you've got 70,000 people a year moving into the region, 50,000 a year moving out. Across 10 years, that's 700,000 new in, 500,000 out. That's going to be a lot of new people that you want to hear from that have made a passionate decision to join our community and are going to have some opinions about who we are.
And part of that ties into who's at the table. We were talking about that not only with Brooklyn, but just in general with these plans. Lorna, there is this large steering committee, and you were talking about how there is a very intentional makeup to this group.
Absolutely. In the past plans, we've had some really great community leaders step up and join us in the creation of them. This time around, since Charlotte has grown so robustly over the past couple decades, we wanted to make sure that we were intentional about bringing the new voices as well as the people who have been here all along in the creation of why Charlotte is so great. So we've really been intentional about, and I know I'm saying that word a lot, but it's one of the
pillars. Just don't say vision or plan. You'll be fine.
It's one of the pillars of the vision plans. And so making sure that we are touching all demographics, that we're getting all age groups of our community. We are making sure that we're getting community leaders from all ranges, scales, and also looking at what are the different industries that we have in our community that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago, like co-working, for instance, is a really good example of that, and how our community is shifting in the way that we change and the way that we work and the way that we are living, and making sure that those folks are represented in this plan. And we held our first steering committee meeting right before we had our community meeting earlier this month, and multiple people on the steering committee came up and said, you know what, I'm really grateful to be a part of this. This is something I never thought I'd be involved in. How did you invite the right people? And we really were thinking, like, okay, who's not traditionally involved in this type of process, but who are the people that make our community rich and viable and attractive? So that's where we went with how we selected our steering committee.
And who might be a couple of examples of, the non-traditional steering committee member?
Well, we have one of the co-founders of Advent Coworking, for example. Let's see, we have...
There's great grassroots leaders that are a part of it, and then there's also the heads of real estate mm-hmm. from large corporations. It's a good mix, and what I loved about the kickoff meeting is all voices were heard. I mean, there was nobody in that room who didn't step forward with passion and ideas, and some of them were pulling in different directions. I can't wait to see what their passion, their executive thinking can do for us across these 18 months as they help respond to what we hear from the community.
And I think that's an interesting change from previous plans. You know, looking at the 1966 plan we've been talking about and the steering committee for that, it's a group of 12 men who, if you know anything about Charlotte history, probably could pick out some of the names, all basically real estate or business or local political magnates. So there were public hearings about the plan back in those days in the 60s, but the steering committee was really, the people you would expect in the real estate, political, and business community in a pretty closed-off group. So I think that's a big change from then to modern times.
I'm guessing they were all white as well.
I don't know for sure, but I believe based on this list, that's likely the case.
Right. So I think it is critically important that we make sure that we don't have an echo chamber, that we've got people who are challenging each other, pushing back on each other, and finding a middle ground that really works for everyone in our community.
And let me just recap, make sure I have this right. So the 2040 Center City Vision Plan will likely be ready at the end of next year, correct? End of 2020?
Yeah, probably early 21 adoption period.
Okay. And then for the comprehensive city plan, that's more toward the spring of 2021?
Correct. So these are going to fold in nicely together.
And then the unified development ordinance would come at the end of 2021. Lorna, particularly for you and Eli, I think a lot of people hear unified development ordinance and, okay, what is that? You know, it just sounds like
it's
one
the
of those
rules.
Yeah.
It's the nitty gritty rules so,
yeah.
of how and
why are those rules?
And, yeah.
Tell us a little bit why those rules are important, and particularly the fact that I don't think this has been updated since 1992.
Well, it's the rules that determine whether a drive-through restaurant or car wash gets built at the entrance to your neighborhood. So a lot of people
now people hear, are paying attention.
A lot of people hear zoning, unified development ordinance, those terms, and they tune out until suddenly there's a development nearby where they go, whoa, holy bleep, how are they going to build that there? And then people get really interested in zoning.
And to Larkin's point earlier, we've had a lot of challenges in the past with these plans and then them not meshing and overlapping correctly. And that's what the Unified Development Ordinance will do. It'll be our land use, it'll be our tree ordinance, our stormwater ordinance. They'll all work together and speak to each other because they're going to be, we're refining everything right now. We're pulling it together. We're making sure there's no gaps and there's no overlap.
And all of these plans traditionally are adopted or endorsed by both the county and the city?
It depends on which type of plan, but yes.
Michael, I have demonstrated great discipline because I think we're 48 minutes into this program, and I haven't asked you yet about where you're going to build David Tepper's palace. So how does a new football stadium factor into, and I know there are many priorities that are probably more important but not as high profile. How does something like an owner coming out and saying he wants to build a retractable roof dome stadium, how does that figure into what you're doing?
I'd begin by saying that the recapitalization of the number one sports entertainment asset of the Carolinas is an exciting opportunity for this community. And you have to love the way David has hit this community with passion and ownership and belief. And we're beginning a process of vetting out what does that mean? What are his aspirations for the team that he purchased that are our Carolina Panthers, and what are the needs going to be over the 10 years? I think what we've known is that having that stadium and all our entertainment assets so easily accessible in a park once environment has been a defining asset for our community. And what we've heard from the Panthers and from David is he sees that and values it.
And particularly when we're talking about Uptown, beyond the stadium, which does get a lot of attention, the Panthers are likely to have a role or a say in a couple of other important areas. You have the Gateway Station project, about 14 acres of land, along 3rd and 4th Ward, that you're looking to redevelop as part of a transit hub. And then you also have the 9 acres that are now used for the practice fields. And obviously the Panthers have their agreement to go to Rock Hill, so that land would be opened up for development. So just curious, anybody here, what do you think about those particular pieces of property and how they fit into future growth?
I think the Gateway Station is going to be just a seismic shift in what that part of Third Ward looks like. That's maybe the project I'm more excited about than anything else we've got going on. If you've ever been to Denver and been to their Union Station or anything like that, I think it could be a huge catalyst in that part of the city. That land that the practice fields are on is going to be something that I think can be far more productive, generate far more tax revenue and excitement and energy down there. So I'm really excited about how that part of the city where I lived when I first moved here, before I bought a house in Plaza Midwood, I lived in Third Ward, and that area of town was very sleepy. And as a early 20s something, I really wanted more activity down there. People that live there now are going to have it, and the ability for people to have access via so many different kinds of transportation, including Amtrak and things like that, to come in for a Panthers game, come in for a baseball game, or in a couple years, you know, have our soccer team over at Memorial Stadium, the Independence. I think people being able to get into downtown and enjoy those new and exciting assets is going to be enormous.
Michael, where are we on Gateway Station in terms of some of the infrastructure has begun to be put together, but there's still a lot of pieces left to be assembled, correct?
Exciting time. The land assemblage was completed a while ago. There was some swapping of land between city and county to make sure we got everything in the right spot. We've got a great steering committee working on that project. The request for qualifications is out. That will be back shortly. Then firms will be shortlisted and we'll go to a proposal stage. But concurrent to that, we've got construction underway, where the bridges are being widened to be able to add track space so that the two active tracks can continue to go through, but you'll have one that you can pull off to handle all that great pedestrian ridership that will be serving that station. One of the great things about that station that you just heard from Councilman Eggleston is that can become an even more important employment center. And that's what major cities do. Is that's the big move around a train station like that, because in the future we will have people commuting in from Greenville and from Greensboro and from Winston coming here for great jobs that are centered around a walkable transit gateway station.
So that land we're talking about is, I guess the best way to describe it is it's just past BB&T Ballpark heading away from the city, correct? Do I have that right?
I think West Trade Street, right when you get to the bridge with the tracks over top.
Greyhound Station.
And most of it, or I guess all of it, is owned by either the city or the state transportation department, correct?
There's some privately owned land.
Oh, there is. Okay.
A part of the Gateway Station District, But the stuff that's a part of the RFP, RFQ is obviously
is the public land.
Publicly owned.
So, Eli, you follow this closely. And in terms of, you know, important pieces of land that can really have a transformative effect, where do you put this one?
I think it's pretty high up there. We do have a lot of surface parking lots left in Uptown Charlotte, as Councilmember Eggleston pointed out, but they are becoming fewer and fewer. There is still a lot of land that could be developed in First Ward around the UNC Charlotte building. There's some activity there. You can see construction cranes for a new multifamily project by Lennar, but there's still a lot of empty land.
Most of that's the land controlled by Daniel Levine's
Yes, family. Levine Properties is still the majority owner of a lot of that land. And if you look at that, I think it's really a blank slate, and there's also a plan in the works to redevelop a lot of that publicly owned land, including sites like the main library branch. So First Ward, I think, is going to transform pretty radically in the next couple decades as well. And just putting this out there, the original 1966 Odell plan called for a zoo in downtown Charlotte. We still don't have a zoo. It's been more than 50 years. I think we should look at a zoo. I'm just putting that out there.
Well, and Lorna mentioned earlier aquarium. So we have zoo, aquarium. We can have a whole zoology wing to uptown, right?
This studio kind of feels like an aquarium. People walk by and peer in at us fish.
I'm glad that you mentioned the library project. Michael, if you can fill people in on that's one of those subvision plans, right? Bank of America and I think some local government were involved in that. What does that entail?
So the North Tryon Vision Plan did a really nice job of talking through a gigantic opportunity. We talked about all the surface lots that are in that district, a lot of concentrated ownership among the county and among Levine Properties and Bank of America. But the two blocks that you just referred to, it's the 7th and Tryon project, and it's the Housing Authority, it's Bank of America, it's the city, it's the county, it's the library. And they've worked through a process to work together through a consultant, have a request for proposals. They are working their way through that, but the idea is to have one master developer for two blocks with subterranean parking and a new library that is being reimagined and a way to...
And that's already funded by the county, I believe, right?
Yep. The base funding. There's still a private fundraise portion of that that has to occur to make that happen. But incredible design, incredible idea. And to have those two blocks that close to Main and Main, and also adjacent to the new Truist headquarters.
Yeah, that's another one. And they're going to Hearst Tower,
yes.
Sixth largest bank. That's just, by the way, we should mention that. Larkin, go ahead.
Yes, as the resident preservationist on City Council, I also have to mention that these plans aren't just about what will be new, but it's about preserving what's old. We're looking out the studio window here at the old Behringer Hotel, also known as the Hall House, and then part of that plan is to preserve and restore that and find a new use for it. So I think, you know, it's a lot of times people look at Charlotte and they say, oh, well, it's just about tearing down and rebuilding, but I think we've got more of an eye now towards preserving the things that help tell our collective story.
Very quickly, I'm assuming our listeners have had so much fun drinking every time they've heard the words vision and plan that they want to know more. So what's the best way to kind of take this further and have a say in some of these plans?
So I'm going to make a plug for both the plans. If you want to stay involved, CharlotteFuture2040.com is where you can go to find out where we're going to be in the community next. And currently we're hosting All-In 2040 Vision Plan on the Charlotte Center City Partners website. You can also follow us on social media. We're all over the place on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So we will be putting a lot of information out into the community in the coming months.
Perfect. We'll all gather in 20 years to recap what we learned. I want to thank Michael Smith. I want to thank Lorna Allen. I want to thank Larkin Eggleston and Eli Portillo. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.